Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service of the UN here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 20th of September. Sorry for this delay. We had a slight technical problem, but now it seems to be working. So I will start immediately by giving the floor to Pascal for an update on the Human Rights Council.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. The United Nations Human Rights Council will begin this afternoon the consideration of item 4 of its agenda, the human rights situations that require its attention. So at 3 p.m., the fact-finding mission on Venezuela will present its latest report. This is the same report that was presented to you by the fact-finding mission during a press conference last Tuesday. And the members of the mission will address the Council in Spanish this afternoon. It will be followed around 4:45 p.m. by the Commission of Inquiry on Syria, which will also present its latest report. And on Monday, this coming Monday, it will be a busy day in terms of country situation. The Council will hear for the first time from the new group of independent experts on Belarus, who will present an oral update. Their first report will be presented at the 58th session in February, March 2025. And at midday, you will hear from Fortuné Gaëtan-Zongo, the special rapporteur on Burundi, who will also present his report. In the afternoon, the Council will hear an oral update from the Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine, and it will be followed by the presentation of a report by High Commissioner Volker Türk on the human rights situation in Myanmar. On Tuesday morning, the Council will hear from Mariana Katsarova, the special rapporteur on Russia, and Ms. Katsarova will hold a press conference on Monday at 1 p.m. in this room. A last note regarding appointment, in case you missed it. Yesterday afternoon, the President of the Human Rights Council appointed Mr. Reid Brody of Hungary as a new member of the Group of Human Rights Experts on Nicaragua. Mr. Brody has worked for 40 years on the forefront of the human rights movement, playing a facilitating role in democratic transitions, building and helping others build stronger NGOs, creating UN mechanisms to fight abuse, and uncovering atrocities and bringing their perpetrators to justice. So we congratulate Mr. Brody and welcome him in his new role. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pascal. Let me see first in the room, Janina, and then we have a question.
Hi, Pascal. Just wondering, do you have more precise timing on Ukraine on Monday? And also, is there a report out that we could see in advance? And on the Russia special special rapporteur, is there any report or anything that she'll be briefing on? Thank you.
Yes, so for now we're experiencing some delay on the program of work, but we expect the Commission of Inquiry to present its oral update on Monday at 3 p.m., so at the beginning of the afternoon meeting. There's no report for this session, but they will issue a press release and we will send it to you under embargo with the oral statement on Sunday. Regarding the special rapporteur on Russia, yes, she's presenting a report that has been published on the HRC reports page. It's available, and she will present the finding of this report during the press conference. Yeah.
And I believe Solange is sending out the invitation to the press conference right now. Yuri.
Oui, merci Pascal. J'ai une petite question sur la commission sur l'Ukraine. Est-ce qu'on aura une conférence de presse avec eux ou pas durant cette session? Merci.
Merci Yuri. Non, la commission d'enquête sur l'Ukraine ne tiendra pas de conférence de presse pour cette session. Par contre, comme je viens de l'indiquer, ils publieront un communiqué de presse qui accompagneront leur mise à jour orale lundi.
Merci beaucoup, Pascal. Je vois pas d'autres questions. Donc, merci et bonne chance pour la prochaine semaine. Et une autre annonce de la part de Marcel Risi pour la CNUSED, et puis on va passer à UNICEF.
Thank you. Merci. Thank you, Alessandra. This is just a brief overview of Secretary General Greenspan's engagements, starting tomorrow at the Summit of the Future, and then, of course, leading into General Assembly Week. As you know, Summit of the Future has three pillars: digital, peaceful, sustainable future, and Secretary Greenspan will be actively involved in two of the three. First, on sustainable future, around her position, which she's been very vocal about, which you're aware of, around international financial architecture, reform, and debt, and approaching debt as a development crisis. Second, on digital, again, with our position, most of you are familiar with a recent digital economy report addressing environmental aspects of all the digital economy, but should be also addressing issues around governance. We had the AI report issued this week, as you know, in New York, and market concentration. This besides various side events over the weekend, SDG Action Zone, and of course, engaging with, again, the G20 ministerial meeting. She will be opening that, again, reinforcing the call for the reform of the international financial architecture, retooling global governance that same day, and engaging with, of course, our key constituency around LDCs and landlocked developed countries, besides, of course, various bilateral meetings. All speeches will be uploaded as they've been delivered. Follow us on our social channels and stay up to date.
Thank you, Marcelo. Any question to Anktad? I don't see any. And of course, we'll speak a little bit later on when I do my announcements about the Summit of the Future. Thank you very much, Marcelo. So let me go now to our first guest. James has brought to us Dr. Paul Ngwakum. And sir, sorry for having misspelled your name on the announcement, but we have corrected it. Dr. Ngwakum, I understand, is the UNICEF's Regional Health Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa. He's coming to us from Bujumbura to tell us about the situation of children. And James, I don't know if you want to start, and then we'll go to Dr. Ngwakum, or we go straight to him.
Well, Dr. Paul, for those who know him well. No, look, he's the perfect person to speak on this, both because he's on the ground, has a medical background, so can give you an anecdotal sense, a medical sense, a technical sense, and English and French. So, Doctor, over to you. Thanks, Alessandra.
Thanks very much for this introduction, and good morning, everyone. I'm speaking from Bujumbura, Burundi, and I must say, from what I've seen, children in Burundi are bearing the brunt of the mpox outbreak with alarming rates of infection and health impact. Of the nearly 600 reported cases, two-thirds are children under 19 years old. And the situation is escalating really rapidly with more than 40% increase in cases over the last 3 weeks. During this visit in Burundi, I have spoken with families, I've spoken with teachers, I've spoken with health workers, who are navigating the dual challenges of treating children and also protecting children from mpox while ensuring that these children continue to go to school. The fears that they've expressed, the fears by these parents are enormous, but we can also notice a striking resilience from these communities. And when I speak with them, they highlighted the critical need for our joint support to keep children safe, not only safe, but in schools and learning. UNICEF in Burundi and in all of Eastern and Southern Africa and globally, but specifically in Burundi, we are working with WHO, we are working with Africa CDC and with other partners, and we are leading the response in key areas, specifically risk communication and community engagement. We are seeing large amounts of online misinformation, which is very dangerous for these communities already at risk. And we are also working on infection prevention and control, mental health and support to parents and frontline health workers who are kind of really scared with the ongoing situation. Mental health, you may know, is very necessary and important, and it helps to dispel myths and also calm fears, because these affected families, they are subject to stigma. They have myths in their communities, and that leads them to be very fearful, maybe because they think this is going to be something more dangerous and more serious than previous situations they've seen, for example, Ebola or COVID-19. But of particular concern for us as UNICEF is the rise of mpox among children under 5 years. This represents about 30% of the reported cases, and this underscores the urgent need for targeted interventions as schools reopen in Burundi. Just a few days ago, on the 16th of September, schools started. UNICEF is coordinating and supporting the government to implement health measures in schools by training staff, ensuring there is water sanitation and hygiene, and making sure that symptoms can be identified and actions taken rapidly to minimize any disruption of schools. But don't make any mistakes. We don't have all the answers. We don't, and I think no one does. This is a rapidly evolving situation, and we are having new strains of infections. Every day, we are thinking of how we can understand better the transmission modalities. And with more information, we'll be able to update our messaging and also our response. But even amid this grim situation, from what I can see being this week in Burundi, I must say that we have not had any case of deaths. We have an opportunity to end this outbreak in a very short time period because the geographical area is kind of limited. And with concerted effort from all partners, I think we can limit the spread, we can contain the virus, and we can stop the outbreak without any loss of life. I am fully aware there is a lot of trouble and competing priorities around the world, far from Burundi. However, we have a chance in Burundi to show we can end this threatening outbreak in a relatively short time if we are together and if we act swiftly. UNICEF is urgently appealing for $58.8 million to scale up its response across 6 African countries, with Burundi included. In these countries, children are most affected. These funds are essential to stop the transmission of mpox, protect children, and maintain critical essential services like education, routine immunization, and other health services. We also need these resources to be able to have interventions of infection prevention and control, supporting vaccination, mental health, treatment centers, as well as stigma. UNICEF is really very committed, and we want to extend these interventions beyond just responding to measures to stop the outbreak. We are equipping frontline health workers. We are working with local communities to ensure that they have the necessary tools, not only to manage the outbreak, at the same time, we are building a resilient system. I can give an example here in Burundi, where we are having displaced populations following the floods, which you know happened in this country, and we are still having the government trying to settle them. We have to ensure that we provide water, which is not only to respond to the mpox outbreak, but water that is going to help these populations be able to make their basic social needs. So these are some of the updates from Burundi, where I am now since this week, and I can be able to share these inputs from our personal observation, discussing with governments and with the different partners, and especially with the communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ngwakum. I will now turn to the journalist for questions, and I see Nina Larsson, our correspondent of AFP, has a question to you.
Yes, thank you very much for the briefing. I had a few questions for you. First, I missed it, I think. Did you say how many cases of mpox there have been in Burundi so far? And then you mentioned that 30% were in children under 5. Do you know if that corresponds with across the African countries that are experiencing outbreaks? And you mentioned that there is particular concern for these children. Could you say a little bit more about why is this so concerning in young children? Thank you.
Doctor, if you can answer a question by question, so I'll give you the floor.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's a very, very interesting question. Yes, we are having all about 600 cases in Burundi. And as I said, more than a third are children less than 19, but 30% are children less than 5 years. And if you look at the data in the DRC, it's the same pattern. So this outbreak is more severe or affects mostly children. And second part of your question, this is very concerning because of the direct consequences to these children. And in most situations, you know, these are children who have low immunity and they are suffering from other underlying problems. For example, they might be having HIV, they might have pneumonia, malaria, diarrhea, and with mpox, you will need critical treatment to be able to avoid them from dying. But you also have secondary consequences, right? You heard me say we have to ensure that schools open. We remember during the COVID days, most of the challenges were not even about the direct consequences, but the secondary consequences of not being able to go to school, not being able to have all the other essential services, vaccination, nutrition, protection. And if those services don't continue, we are going to have more challenges beyond the consequences of the direct challenges or the direct consequences of mpox. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nina has a follow-up.
Yeah, thank you. Also, sorry, I had another question, which was that you mentioned that there haven't been any deaths from mpox in Burundi, if I heard you correctly. How would you explain that, considering that there have been quite a lot of deaths in DRC, for instance? And do you think that maybe they're going undetected? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's another question which we are also asking in the field. But I think it's more important to ask why are there more deaths in the Congo and not here, and not why are there no deaths here? Because as I said, it's an evolving disease and we have to do some research to be able to understand the patterns. But mpox, as you may know, is not a very severe disease if it doesn't meet with an underlying condition. You might just need to have it and the virus, and after some time you get better. But most children are having underlying conditions, malnutrition, HIV, other infections. And as I said, we have to be able to do more operational research to understand why in Burundi we are not having the same pattern as in the Congo. But that said, we have to be cautious because maybe we don't have all the data, but as for the data we have, we need to investigate much more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Don't see other question in the room, so let me go to the platform. Emma Farge, Reuters.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering how you are managing with schools then. Are you putting in COVID kind of era protocols in order for these children to continue learning while self-isolating? How are you addressing that challenge? And can you elaborate also a bit more on how you think you could end the outbreak there? You said there's an opportunity. What would that entail, and how quickly do you think that could be done? Thank you.
I think, if I may come in rapidly, those are two very interesting questions. And the first one on schools, we were discussing yesterday afternoon with the Minister of Education, as well as with the Minister of Health. And I don't think we are on virgin ground. We already had some systems that were put in place during COVID-19 outbreak. And for this mpox outbreak, we have to kind of revitalize these systems. Number one, COVID and mpox are different, so we have to be able to educate the teachers and the children on how to stay safe and prevent themselves from mpox. The second thing is putting in place all what I cited in my submission, key interventions for water, sanitation, and hygiene, and key interventions to make sure that they use these installations in terms of hand washing and avoiding body contact while in school. Yes, ending the outbreak, as I was discussing with the government and the different actors on the field here, we did agree treatment or creating treatment centers is good because we have to stop morbidity and mortality. But the most important thing is to break the transmission chain. And I think this is ongoing. We are saying we have to move more into the community to make sure that we provide risk communication and community engagement. And that is what UNICEF is taking forward to make sure that we have an idea of where are the cases, we have an idea at what are the risk factors, and we educate the population to be able to stay safe. But at the same time, putting in place infrastructure and providing the services for them to be able to have a safe environment. Simple soap for hand washing, water available for this hand washing, and also ensure that we have interventions around mental health and psychosocial support. I think I did submit that as well, because if people are having meets and they are scared and they don't want to come forth, it will take a longer time. But I think we put this package together and we'll be able to reach the results. And I did say for this, we need quite some money, $58.8 million, which should be used across 6 countries in Africa, including Burundi.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Lisa Schlein, Voice of America.
Yes, good morning. And good morning to you, Doctor. I have a few questions for you, and then I also have a couple of questions for Margaret Harris, who is online, if I may. First is, there are 6 countries you mentioned that are infected by Mpox. Is Burundi the worst situation after the DRC? And then you mentioned that there were some new strains that were in the offing that were happening. Are you concerned about that? Will that create greater problems for you in order to try to end this this epidemic? You were talking about that it was possible indeed to end the Mpox there, and if you could elaborate upon that, how you intend to do this. Are you getting the vaccines that you need? And are the vaccines that you have appropriate for the new strains? I'm sorry to barrel all of this on you. One more question for you. You mentioned the problems with stigma. Why is there so much stigma surrounding this this disease? And then if I may, for Margaret, unless Alessandra, you want me to hold off on that.
Is that also about Burundi? If it's about Burundi, I think we can take it now.
It's about Mpox, but it's related, I would think.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thanks, Margaret. First of all, you put some information in the chat. Could you send that information by email? It's a lot easier to access it. And could you give a kind of overview of the situation of what is happening right now with Mpox, with Burundi, with DRC, whether you think you're actually getting a handle on this situation or is it running out of control? Thank you.
Okay, let's start with Dr. Nwakum first.
Yeah, thank you very much, Liz. I think you had very interesting questions. I gather 4 issues to address. The first one, yes, after the DRC, we have Burundi, which is having a high number of cases in the region. About the strains, yes, there is a strain called clade 1, and specifically clade 1B. And research shows this clade is more severe, it's more virulent. It spreads faster and it might lead to more death if it meets with underlying conditions. So that is it. The third issue is about vaccines. Yes, there are negotiations and follow-up for vaccines to be made available. WHO recently gave an EUL emergency use list for one of the vaccines, and UNICEF is moving forward had already started negotiations for the procurement, and I think we're going to have quite a number in 2024 and another batch coming in 2025. There are donations and there are some donors also, some other agencies, the Africa CDC following up for vaccines. Stigma, why stigma? I don't know if you've seen a picture of a patient with mpox. It's scary. It's scary sometimes even after treatment, you are having long-term complications with scars. That's number one, and people don't want to have scars on their faces. Number two, the mode of transmission, not all of it, but there is a sexual connotation in transmission, and sex in Africa is not something that is spoken of on a daily basis. And if they think you are having a sexually transmitted disease, it stigmatizes you as well in terms of integration in your society. And we try to explain that this is not the case. Most children have it from body to body contact or contact with animals or contact with infected materials, which is not having anything to do with human to human sexual contamination. So those are the issues around stigma, and we are still researching to be able to understand other context specific stigmatizing conditions. So it's ongoing, and I think we'll be there. I guess I answered all your questions, but you can follow up if there are issues I omitted, because it was quite a package.
Thank you very much. Margaret, you want to take the question? I see in the chat there are quite a few exhaustive numbers, figures, and maybe indeed if you can send them by email, but maybe you want to give a global update, Aurélie?
Certainly. Those numbers that I've put in the chat are from the numbers we had as of 14 September. We're going to have a sit-rep out this afternoon, so if you can wait, we'll have updated numbers. But I think they already give you a very clear idea of the size and the increasing size of the outbreak, that we have 25,093 suspected mpox cases from the 1st of January to the 8th of September 2024. And these include both tested and untested cases. So sometimes the numbers are confusing because the only confirmed ones are those that are tested, and most are not tested. And among those suspected cases, we have had 723 deaths. As we've already discussed, the three countries reporting the most suspected mpox cases in 2024 are the Democratic Republic of Congo with 21,835 suspected cases and 717 deaths. In Burundi, we have 1489, that's 1,489 suspected cases and no deaths reported. And in Nigeria, we have 935 suspected cases and no deaths reported. As for the overall response and what we're doing, and really important question, the critical work has just been outlined for you by my colleague from UNICEF. Yes, vaccination is going to be a very useful tool, particularly for trying to break the chains of transmission, to put people who are immune protected into those chains. But viruses spread primarily through close personal contact. Sex is one part, but it's really within families. And when people are living in difficult conditions, if they don't have access to the materials, to the soap, to the clean bedding, to the clean clothing, it's very, very difficult for them to not transmit. So the work my colleagues are doing at UNICEF, when you talk about risk communication, it's not just about telling people what to do, it's about making it possible for them to do it. And this is absolutely critical work. The response is made much more difficult by the context. We've got insecurity, a lot of conflict in many of the affected areas, and we've got concurrent outbreaks of other diseases such as measles and chickenpox. And as mentioned, many of the children whom we've seen horribly, sadly die in the Democratic Republic of Congo were very immunosuppressed through being severely malnourished and having suffered the effects of conflict, and also perhaps having other diseases at the same time. It's not clear whether it's more severe. It may indeed be that it's in a population who simply cannot respond immunologically to yet another threat. And what have we done? Across the nine countries, we've trained more than 1,600 health workers. And we're tomorrow, more than 33 tons of supplies are expected to arrive in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi. We're doing, we have things like having to provide critical fuel shortage to ensure that that partners and the government can conduct their daily responses. And we've also sent a large team, including our clinical care team. Unfortunately, I wanted to bring our clinical care person today, actually, to speak it to you, but she's in Ecuador at the moment, to outline exactly what we're doing. But hopefully we'll be able to bring them to you next week. I think that's it for me. Over.
Thank you. That would be really interesting. Nina, wait a second, because Emma had also a follow-up, and I'll come to you. Emma.
Thank you. Yeah, there was just one part of my question that was unanswered. How quickly do you think the outbreak could be brought under control in Burundi with that strategy that you outlined, Doctor? Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That's a very interesting question. And epidemiologically, it's very difficult to make firm statements that procrastinating a outbreak is going to stop. On this day, I think it depends on many factors. And the first one is, number one, what are the key actions that we are doing to give an enabling environment for this outbreak to be stopped? I think if we have all the resources in terms of doing the key intervention, number one, risk communication and community engagement, accompanied by an enabling environment where these populations, they are having the right tools in terms of infection and prevention controls, tools and supplies. I think we can stop it very quickly, but I don't think I want to give you a date, but I just think this can be stopped within a very few weeks to come.
Thank you very much, Nina.
Yeah, thank you. So I had a few questions, I think maybe for Margaret, but also for the doctor. If you could say about the vaccines, are not approved necessarily for the use in children or under 18, I think. So how big a concern is that when there's so many children who are affected? And when it comes to the death toll in the DRC, I may have missed it, but what's the percentage of children among those who have died? Thank you.
Who wants to take that? Doctor first, maybe, and then Margaret?
Yeah, I think I will maybe leave Margaret talk about the epidemiological situation in the DRC. But for vaccines, I just want to maybe underline that vaccines is only one tool that can be used to protect children and communities against mpox. And we are, in addition to vaccines, deploying other different tools which I mentioned. But as for vaccines, as I said, there are efforts ongoing. There is one vaccine which I said also has got EUR from WHO. And unfortunately, as you did underline, it cannot be used for children. And I don't want us to bank all our interventions on vaccine. Vaccines is just one tool, but there are many other tools to be able to make sure that we stay safe from this. And I think as we move forward, we'll be able to come out with vaccines that are going to be more appropriate as we go and as we learn more on this outbreak. Over.
Margaret, would you like to add anything? I don't see Margaret appearing. So
sorry, I couldn't unmute. Okay. But I think that was more than adequately answered. I don't have the specific percentage on the breakdown on the number of deaths among children. So I don't have an absolutely specific percentage, but you can safely say that sadly there is a high percentage of deaths among of those who've died. A considerable number are children, sadly.
OK, Okay, thank
but
you.
I'll see if I can find a breakdown for you in our CIRET, but I couldn't find one just in that short moment.
Thank you very much, Margaret. And again, if you could share the figures for those who don't have access to the chat straight away, especially the people in the room. Okay, so thank you very much. I'd like to thank Dr. Nwakum very much for this update. Please keep us informed of developments and good luck with the work in the next weeks. Let me now turn to my left. I have the pleasure to welcome Dominique Bourgeon. He doesn't need an introduction to you, director of the FAU Liaison Office in Geneva. Dominique, you have an update on the impact of La Niña on food security.
Yes, thank you very much, Alessandra. Well, you will recall that a couple of months ago, actually in April, we came before you with a number of colleagues from other agencies alerting you of the global report on food crisis that was presenting that about 282 million people around the world were facing acute hunger. Unfortunately, we are coming back to you because this number might rise again because of the adverse effect of La Niña, which, as you know, is a recurring climate phenomenon that brings unusually cold temperature in the Pacific and which often leads to extreme weather events such as drought, floods, cyclone, and excessive rainfalls. Depending on the model which we have at our disposal, we see that there is a between 55 and 71% chance of a La Niña onset in September to November 2024, and it is expected to persist through January and March 2025. The particular concern and why we really want to draw your attention is that this La Niña event comes immediately after a very strong El Niño in 2023-2024. And you may recall that in particular, Southern Africa experienced devastating droughts. The Horn of Africa saw major floods coming after years of droughts. And overall, we consider that El Niño affected over 60 million people worldwide and was, of course, one of the drivers of acute food insecurity over the past month. As affected regions still actually struggle with the impact and the aftermath of El Niño, it's clear that the impending La Niña threatens to exacerbate an already very fragile situation. As you know, one of the impact of climate change is the significant increase in the number of extreme weather events, increase in their frequency and intensity, and it's clear that extreme weather events such as those associated with La Niña. The recent floods and typhoons across Africa, Asia, and Europe are, I would say, a stark reminder of how global this problem of extreme weather events is. Countries like Myanmar, Vietnam, and Nigeria have faced devastating floods and typhoons. And I would say these events show how vulnerable many regions are with those extreme weather events. Within that context, agri-food systems are, of course, highly vulnerable, highly sensitive to climate shift, and often have to deal with prolonged impacts in terms of degradation of soil and impact on water resources. It is clear that when we have disrupted planting season, reduced crop yields, and the loss of livestock, it makes it difficult for farmers to maintain production, and it pushes millions of them into acute food insecurity and poverty. And what we know for sure is that when farmers lose their livelihood, lose their livestock, are unable to crop their land, it is very, very difficult for them to recover. It takes actually years for them to be in extreme poverty. Very difficult for them to recover It is therefore critical for us to work towards protecting their assets, their livelihood, and in that sense, we need to also change and the way we do response, and we cannot wait until it is too late to do it. As a matter of fact, since 2015-16, when there was already a massive El Nino event, FAO and partners have been making significant changes in the way we approach those disasters, using early warnings and being able to establish flexible funding mechanism to enable what you know as anticipatory action. And evidence from all those actions shows that these anticipatory measures are cost effective, that they reduce losses, and that they protect better food security outcomes. Thanks to this progress and the generous financial support we have received from a number of partners, FAO was able to act early in the context of the recent El Nino. We have been protecting the livelihood of about 1.7 million people in 24 countries, safeguarding their livelihoods and enabling them to continue producing food despite those shocks. Now, basically, what we are trying to do is to replicate this proactive approach. And this is in that context that we have launched a La Niña Anticipatory Action and Response Plan that will be shared with you together with the talking points immediately after this this press conference. And this plan aims to basically help about 10.5 million people who are most at risk in 39 countries in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. And for that, we require about 318 million in funding to provide urgent targeted support to mitigate the severe impact of La Niña in induced weather extremes. Activities that are proposed include provision of stress-tolerant seeds to boost local food production, animal health support and feed to livestock owners, equipment to protect key assets of small fishers, and cash base transferred, among others. In finishing, I would like to stress that we have an opportunity to make a real difference if we manage to act now. This is what we have demonstrated in the context of our anticipatory action. And by acting now, before the next disaster hit, we can save lives and protect communities from falling deeper into hunger and poverty. And I would add that when we have the information ahead, we owe it to the people to act in advance. And it is also much more cost effective. So thank you very much, Alessandra.
Much more. Thank you very much, Dominique. Any question in the room to FAO? Don't see any online. I don't see either. So thank you very much. I think you said you'll distribute this information, so I count on Kia to do so. Thanks for coming and briefing us, Dominique, on this important subject. So now I am left with a few announcements. Then maybe you'll have other questions, I understand, for colleagues online. So let me start by the usual announcements on the committee, on the Human Rights Committee. We have the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which is concluding its 76th session today at 5:30. The Committee on Enforced Disappearances will open next Monday its 27th session at Palais Wilson. The countries to be reviewed under this session will be Ukraine, Morocco, and Norway. As you know, so as you know, we are going to start today various events related to the Summit of the Future. Marcello spoke about it a little bit, but I would just like, first of all, to let you know that the pre-summit, I would say what we call the Summit of the Future Action Days, is starting today in New York. These action days have been decided, have been organized in order to generate additional opportunities for the engagement of all actors into the Summit of the Future. They are convened by the Secretary General. As I said, they are starting today and they will continue tomorrow at the United Nations headquarters in New York. Bringing together representatives from member states, civil society, private sector, academia, local and regional authorities, especially youth, and many more, these action days will provide an opportunity for broad engagement and inclusion. They will kick off this afternoon, New York time, with a youth-led afternoon. This will include a high-level dialogue with the Secretary General at 2 p.m. New York time. Saturday, the program will focus on three priority themes: digital and technology, peace and security, and sustainable development and financing. In addition to these three themes, there will also be a dedicated focus throughout the day on future generations. Lots of confirmed participants, including heads of states and government, ministers, senior UN officials, civil society, representatives for private sector, and other actors. In the framework of these action days, I would like to bring your attention on an event which is organized by UNOG, by our colleagues of the Beyond Lab, that, as you know, is part of the Office of the Director General, in cooperation with UN Trade and Development and Rethinking Economics International. This side event is entitled Moving Beyond GDP, a Youth Perspective on Measuring What We Value, to bring together youth voices and policymakers discussing how we can realign our economies with human and planetary priorities by moving beyond GDP, emphasizing young people's role and perspective. And we have included all the information related to this event on the UNOG website. Everything I'm telling you, of course, we have a problem with the time lag, of course, but everything is webcast on UN Web TV, so you can follow every proceeding. Then we will go into the summit itself. That will start on the 22nd of September. There will be a pre-opening at, I think it's 8:30 a.m. New York time, followed by the plenary opening segment at 9 a.m. New York time, when we expect member states to adopt the outcome document of the Summit of the Future, which is entitled A Pact for the Future. That, as you know, has been the object of very, very intense intergovernmental negotiations. The Pact of the Future should have two annexes, the Global Digital Compact and the Declaration on Future Generations. So we will see this hopefully adopted at 9 a.m. on the 22nd of September. There will be statements by the President of the General Assembly, the Secretary General, two youth representatives. Plenary session will follow, interactive dialogues too. Same thing on Monday, 23rd of September. We will have plenary sessions, interactive dialogues, and the plenary will be organized very late for us. It will be at 8:30 p.m. New York time, so I think we will be sleeping, but we will see the conclusion on the day after on UN platforms. So we have all the information. There is a press kit for this. There is also, of course, press kit for the high-level debate, which will follow the Summit of the Future. If you have any request on documentation, don't hesitate to ask us. The Summit of the Future, as the Secretary General said, it's really once in a life generation occasion to change, really, how, not so much the what, but the how we do multilateralism. He said at his press conference, we can't create a future fit for our grandchildren with systems built for our grandparents. The Summit of the Future is an essential first step towards making global institutions more legitimate, effective, and fit for the world of today and tomorrow. It cannot fail. I urge member states to seize this opportunity. And the last point Sorry, two last points. Just to also note on the Summit of the Future that we have published, we have an op-ed of the Secretary General has been published on Les Temps Online, so I invite you to have a look at this too. Just two final points. As every year, the Secretary General report on the work of the organization has been published. That was yesterday. We sent you the information and the link to the report, which is official in six official available in six official languages and in two accessibility formats, in line with our disability and inclusion strategy. The theme of this year's report is Resolve, and it's connected to last year's theme, which was Determined, with further emphasis on action. It presents a dual meaning of the organization having resolve and the United Nations working to resolve global challenges. So you have it online. I hope you'll have a look at it. And then just a very last point. As you all know, 21st of September is also International Day of Peace. This year, it's the 25th anniversary of the United Nations General Assembly's adoption of the Declaration and Program of Action on a Culture of Peace. In that declaration, the UN most inclusive body recognized that peace not only the absence of conflict, but also requires a positive, dynamic, participatory process where dialogue is encouraged and conflicts are solved in a spirit of mutual understanding and cooperation. And if there is one thing we need today, it's peace. Obviously, this will also be the object of the summit of discussion at the Summit of the Future on Action Day 2, and we have distributed to you the message of the Secretary General on this on the occasion of this important day. And I think I gave you all the information I had for you, all the announcements. So if there is no other question, I don't see any in the room. Let me see if there's any on the platform. I don't see any, so please don't hesitate to come back to us on this, on all these events if you need more information. Otherwise, thank you very much for following this briefing, and I wish you a very good weekend, and I'll see you on Tuesday. Thank you.